For the record, I'm Mike McLean. We're going to be opening the House Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness at our unconventional but happy 0830 hour. Normally we do afternoon meetings, as everybody knows. I appreciate you moving your schedules to be able to be available today. My promise to you is we will be certainly out of here by the 9:30 time frame that was recommended, suggested, directed by the majority leader and the minority leader for caucus time. We have a couple of things to do today for in terms of committee business, none of it legislation, but I want to start with saying thank you very much to our invited speaker today for making again a schedule change. Looking forward to hearing about this important topic. Dr. Belante is really a pioneer throughout the nation on threat and support related to activities that are in the news again today. And I'm going to, with that, please introduce yourself for the record, and you have our attention.
Great. Good morning. Thank you, Chair Evans and committee members. Rebecca Belante from Chemeketa Community College. And I thought about you guys this morning, thinking about all the different information that you're receiving. And not that I'll put my counselor hat on right now, but I hope you take care of yourselves after this session, because you get a lot of information. You'll receive some information today that is not a fun topic for us to talk about, but I'm very passionate. I've worked at Chemeketa for 15 years. My background is mainly as a counselor with people with psychiatric disabilities and all disabilities, and the career has changed over time to where we've started a new program called the Threat and Disaster Resource Center, and it's actually just a few blocks away from here, the Capitol. I feel very blessed. I get to work for Diane McLaren, who's back here with our board member, Ed Dodson, and she's helped with more of giving structure and guidance and growth for this program. As you can imagine, you know, as Chair Evans said, another incident happened today. So the request for support, training, consultation has really grown. The program's only 2 years old. With that being said, even though you mentioned nationwide, and that's true, we get requests, and I have gone throughout the nation, we have made it a goal just a few months ago that our focus is on Oregon. There's enough work here in Oregon, in our backyard, for us to keep really busy. Let's move ahead here. I don't know if you saw this at OSU just, I think it was yesterday, so a real threat that several of us community colleges have also dealt with the same individual. OSU also is dealing with it. And so with threat assessment, what I'm going to do is talk about threat assessment and then also the recovery aspect. So right now it's a threat assessment. And I have to remind myself that not everyone knows this term or what it is, and so I'll have to slow down a little bit and because I really want you to understand. It's not threat assessment is not doing the locks or cameras, even though those are great things. It's not about you know, more cops, although that's great as well. It's really this method of having a team, a multidisciplinary team that has been recommended by the FBI, Secret Service, and U.S. Department of Education as a way to prevent mass killings. And as you notice, I didn't say mass shootings, I've said mass killings, because it's not always with guns, as we all know that. So that's threat assessment. I've been starting to use more behavioral threat assessment, because people in the security industry, they get confused about more risk assessment. So behavioral threat assessment, where a trained team, whether it's in a school, whether it's in the community, the trained team are analyzing facts of concern, like this one at OSU, to put together a plan to prevent the event from happening, which I think we'd all like to see more of that prevention. So we see this in the media or just in conversations of what made that person snap? You know, the person down in Florida, you know, what tipped them over the edge? And most of the time it is a male, but what made them snap? They don't snap. So I get a little irritated, going, no, they don't just wake up one morning and say, I'm going to go shoot up a mall. That's something that they plan, and sometimes for a very long period of time. So when we do the threat assessment training, this document is a big focus point. And I won't spend a lot of time, but I just think it's good for you to have this awareness that there's this pathway that individuals, and this is also true for terrorism. There's a lot of parallels between our U.S. Mass shootings and also the terrorism, where you find out where or if the person even is on this pathway towards violence.
Dr. Bolland, if I could, this is what you put in OLIS, right? That's
yes.
Up. So if the people,
yep.
So if our committee want to follow along and.
Yes. So there's handouts for today's presentation, also for yesterday's that didn't happen, but some different materials.
But thank you.
Absolutely. And please ask questions, or if you get tired of listening to my voice, just say, hey. I appreciate the questions. But this pathway to violence, someone could be on this pathway for a short time or a long time, but generally it starts with a grievance, or it might start with a cause, a belief. Might be racism, might be KKK, might be politics, or they just might be really ticked off at the Representative Evans, and they're really focused. That got your attention, huh?
There's plenty of people in that category right now.
So. Maybe. And that, you know, there's grievances all over the place, so that's not the problem. And so that's where you look at the total situation and see if that person then is not only grieving Evans, but then they're perseverating and they can't think of anything else other than what they could do to cause harm, and just consumes them. And so we look at, are they doing some research and planning? Are they actually visiting the location where he lives or where he works? And then the attack. And so the beauty with threat assessment, behavioral threat assessment, figuring this out, and then with that multidisciplinary team, you're putting together a supportive plan, which I love that piece as a counselor type, to get them off this pathway towards violence. And there have been several, I mean, we do this all the time, and there's things are ramped up, several situations where I truly believe we're on this pathway and we were able to get them off the pathway towards violence through doing active behavioral threat assessment. Look like.
Chair Evans.
Go ahead.
Just a quick question, because reading this and learning what we've had about the perpetrator in Florida, it looks like there were several opportunities to intervene, and this is kind of what you're explaining right here. Is this
absolutely
correct?
Yep. And I think maybe it's this next slide. There you go. The individuals that lost their lives just what was it, a week and a half ago. Mm-hmm. There's a difference between targeted and reactive violence. And so with threat assessment, we're focused on when someone is planning, so not reactionary. This other picture is like road rage, or someone that's just like ticked off. There's a difference, and even though we're concerned about that, we're really concerned about this predatory violence, like this perpetrator in Florida.
So for some people, maybe the term premeditated might be helpful in this.
That absolutely.
That it is a focused, using all the intellect, all the capacity of the human brain before an event, as opposed to something that's a stimulus that just has a reaction to.
Nicely said. Yep, and that's part of what we also look at. Does the person have the mental capacity to pull off the event? Because sometimes we get some threats and situations where we're concerned, but we are not as concerned when they don't have the capacity. Mm-hmm. Did you have another question?
Go ahead. We're having a small technical issue up here. That's what we're trying to fight. But you keep going.
Okay, I'll keep going. But could I help you with your technical issue? The reason I have this picture of the teams is because I do talk to lots of organizations, and it's not just schools. We have private sector that are doing threat assessment, community-based threat assessment. It needs to be done with a team. And so you might hear someone saying, oh, yeah, we do threat assessment. I do it. I have a checkoff list. That's not the best practice. So having multidisciplinary teams, and I'm proud of Oregon. I mean, we have the longest community-based threat assessment team in the world, not just the nation, but the world. So when I did my research, I checked this out, and it's true. They are really good here in Salem, Oregon, Salem-Keizer. Then also Newburgh. They have a threat assessment team. They meet every week out at Yamhill. Polk County. We have an awesome behavior. So these are community-based teams that organizations can tap into. Portland developed one 2 years ago, and they're doing a great job. And so we're going to see more of these community teams, as well as companies, schools, churches are developing teams. So this is great, but it's also great for you to hear this. So clues, and I did add, I think the perpetrator from Florida, as you mentioned, Representative Meek, about there were clues. And I hate to point fingers because I know that that's frustrating. At the same time, we need to learn quickly what happened and what went wrong because we don't want another situation to happen again. I mean, this picture, see, and by the way, do you see I cover their faces mm-hmm. and their names? So all of our training, we really promote no notoriety. And there's a campaign that you can take a pledge. It was geared for the media, but really it's anyone talking about these things. Most of these perpetrators do it for that fame and glory, to outdo the last person, to get a higher body count. So that notoriety is huge. They want to be famous. Anyway, so you can still kind of get an idea of who they are just for the context of I want you to learn about this. But the individual, did any of you hear about this? In the summertime over in Pennsylvania, a young man who shot three employees at a very country-like supermarket.
Right. Yeah.
Didn't get a whole lot of media attention, kind of comes and goes, probably because there wasn't a high enough body count. But that situation, there's hours and hours of media online where he planned for several years and talked about how he was going to go into his place of work, how he was going to close off the doors, which gun, and that he named his gun. I mean, so he just detailed. And we're seeing that more. Before, it was more in their journals. It would be in their conversation. But with the social media piece, we're seeing a lot of that. Mm. And in Florida, as you mentioned, a lot of people reported, right? And that's what we encourage, is the reporting. So it's like, bravo, they reported. The flip side, do people know what to do with this report? I mean, don't assume every FBI person has this type of training. Don't assume every school district. And so there's still a lot that will be learned over the next few years. Sometimes it takes a long time to get the real facts. But it's not just about the reporting, because we want to encourage reporting, but we also need to have teams of professionals that are knowing how to handle the case effectively. These little comments here are examples of how there were clues ahead of time. It's called leakage. Now, this document, I was thinking, okay.
Quick,
oh, go ahead.
Chair Evans,
go ahead.
Let me ask you a question related to that leakage. And I'm not sure if the research has been done on this yet. But in some cases, are these, you know, perpetrators, are they looking to be intervened with that leakage? Are they looking for help or, you know? Because it seems that is the pattern now, and maybe that's their way to get outreach. And it just seems that's the pattern. Because why would you publicize it
exactly
otherwise?
And there is a little bit of research on this topic. What is most common is they're planning, and they're so consumed. And a colleague pointed this out because it's kind of a funny term, leakage, you know, that they're so consumed that it does leak out either unintentionally or intentionally. Most of the time, it's unintentional. Mm-hmm. And so they're leaking it out. Something, maybe it's a cry for help. Some people say it's more to help with that notoriety, but there's leakage, whichever area.
Well, thank you.
If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
So this doc, I was like thinking you guys probably don't want a ton of documents, but if you do, email me, and I can.
Actually, if you could email us
uh-huh.
the materials you think are like a 100 or 200 level, because with the new legislative research policy shop that they're trying to develop, Sione for emergency preparedness and all of the issues related is building a library of different things that are out there. So that
oh, fantastic.
Be,
okay.
So just on
and
that Sione note.
And Sione was very helpful with getting the things uploaded. What I was worried about is to overwhelm with so much information and then...
I wouldn't send it to all of us. I'd send it to
perfect.
To him.
And then you guys can decide if you want to go fishing or if you want to go fishing with some materials.
And too. Moving forward, if there are perhaps... legislative concepts moving forward, the baseline research that you may be referencing will be available as they put together the basically the tools to
Yes.
do that. So,
oh, that's a great idea. Yes. So. Okay, I'll work with Sione on that. This document was just published last year, 2017. And so it's one that I would start with because it gives a great picture of what's current, what's promoted, what's best practices, and it's really this behavioral threat assessment. So I'll have other documents that I can also upload because it's more for the private sector, specific workplace violence, but the roads lead back to this behavioral threat assessment team notion. Is there another question? Okay. Okay, I'm going to switch gears a little bit to the recovery aspect of disaster behavioral health. Now, the program I mentioned that we're growing, I didn't predict that this part of the program would grow as much as it has, to the point that we even changed our name to the Threat and Disaster Resource Center. So the recovery element, we are just getting bombarded with requests for help and assistance. And so what I'm hoping that you'll learn today is how important it is for organizations and communities to know how to respond quickly to the emotional support.
Now I actually have a question. You use the term recovery. In emergency preparedness, there's the mitigation
Yep.
preparedness, and then there's the response and recovery, two very different pieces.
Yep.
I would assume that emotional support in the moment of responding would be different than the long-term supports as you try to put Humpty Dumpty back together again.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the same?
Yeah, let me address
in behavioral?
That because actually we, our program and on our webpage, we follow the same structure, and I kind of skipped the middle.
Okay, but responses.
Which we do have, you know, the active threat, run, hide, fight. We're looking at doing search and rescue elements. So we have this prevention, what to do during, and then the recovery.
Okay.
And we did have a group discussion about the recovery because you're right, Chair Evans, is that right as the event is taking place, you need to have emotional support right then, but then also a week after,
right.
3 months, a year down the road. So we did put that all into
okay.
the recovery category.
Okay.
Want to remind people, it's not all about shootings. Any type of disaster, we look at how you can help people in the community, support them emotionally. So whether it's fires, floods, earthquake, but one that I think at least impacted me and maybe several of us in the room was what happened down at Roseburg at Umpqua mm-hmm. Community College. I'm really proud of the state for how we pulled together. Oregon Health Authority's been great, and we continue to partner with people. Great to have Mike Harriman as a policy advisor that really understands disaster behavioral health. I mean, that's pretty cool at that level that he gets it. And so disaster behavioral health, I mean, here we have all these great resources that come in and help, but reminding people that we need to include the element of the disaster behavioral health, the emotional support for individuals. Now, Dr. Ron Gloss, who was going to co-present with me yesterday, and hopefully you'll get a chance to meet him, he's just a rock solid, great person, but really our leader or champion within this new program for the disaster behavioral health element. So you hear sometimes, you know, trauma, crisis, some people call it trauma teams, crisis team, and really disaster behavioral health, that is the official researched terminology, because trauma is something different. Even though someone might go through a horrific experience, it doesn't mean they're necessarily going to be traumatized, right? We hope that they're not. In fact, it's a very small percentage of people that are traumatized. So the disaster behavioral health, I believe, and research states that if you can move quickly to provide that emotional support, that the likelihood of people having that long-term PTSD, having issues down the road, will be eliminated. I mean, that's pretty cool. I mean, so if we can go quickly, and especially for first responders who need that support right away, then the benefits is going to just be huge, not for just the person, but for our communities. How am I doing with time?
Probably another 10 minutes.
Okay.
But just so you know, and committee members, I over the course of the interim, I suspect that Dr. Belante and her team will be back at least one more time as we set the table for 2019, because I think there's some tools that the state can help with, and I want to be able to engage on that. So
good. Thank
this
you.
Is the first
Thank
of you. Hopefully a couple of times.
Yeah. And,
Chair, I'm sorry to interrupt. But related to this topic, I heard a great story about one of the students that was recovering from the Parkland incident. And what I heard was that the counselors were telling them, talk about this, get this off your chest. And this is kind of related to what you're talking about, our changes of before we probably didn't address it as directly or wanted it to cool down. But it looks like part of this, you know, trying to mitigate the future PTSDs to help get it started right away? Is that what?
Yeah. Boy, this is a great segue into a story I was going to tell you, because my background, as I mentioned, is a counselor, right? And my doctoral, my PhD is in counselor education with a focus on threat assessment. So as a counselor educator, I think I know a little bit about counseling. And a few years ago at Chemeketa, well, this was more than a few, so 10 years ago at Chemeketa, we had a horrible accident that impacted a student that everyone knew, someone in your community that everyone just knows, has a beautiful smile. It was on a off-campus activity, team building, doing those ropes course, the harness broke, he fell. People are there trying to figure out, how is he doing? Is he gonna, he's fine. Today he lived through, but there was a period of time we didn't know, and we were pretty shook up. So as the students come back to the campus, and we're trying to establish support and counseling, and so I have my counselor hat on, thinking, okay, the other counselors have this type of training, right? Because they didn't teach me in my counselor training program. So I bring in other counselors, and we fumbled. And I watched some situations unfold to where it was realized it's a complete different tool set. And people make an assumption that counselors have this training. They don't. So that's a whole other topic that I work with different universities on their counselor accreditation. And it is changing. But just so you know, counselors, when they go in, they're used to saying, I was going to say meek, but meek, how are you feeling about what just happened? That's not necessarily the right technique at that time to be asking, but that's natural for a counselor to say that. And so with my little story of trying to figure out, well, what is it? What is the best way for me to respond? And we need to know how to do this. And so with this disaster behavioral health and the intervention that we use at the early stages is called psychological first aid, PFA. So psychological first aid.
Thank you.
And it's different from, you might hear, mental health first aid, which is good, but it's different. This is for after a disaster happens, and people who might be counselors, but most of the time they're not, that are intervening and helping with the situation. Good morning.
Good morning.
So psychological first aid, UCLA down in California, they got a grant through SAMHSA, which is great support for people with mental health and addiction issues. They developed curriculum, and we have embraced it and rolled out training for psychological first aid. Under Dr. Gloss's guidance, it has just grown to the point to where we're like, okay, we need this in Spanish, don't we? Because I was part of a response, another Chemeketa response. We had a year of just these horrible incidents where we had a lot of Spanish speakers, parents of individuals that wanted to know if their kids were alive. Not many Spanish responders, and we did the best we could, and we did have some staff. But so one of our goals, and we have something scheduled in Woodburn, is to get people with these tools for psychological first aid. It wouldn't be a bad thing for our local legislatures to even learn about, so keep that in mind. I mean, it's not just for the clinician. It's if to help your neighborhood, to help your community, or just have a better understanding of what they say or what they shouldn't say. Here's the trainers, although things have gotten so busy, as I mentioned, that we're doing another train the trainer, so we're bringing in 7 more trainers as these requests come up around Oregon. One thing I was thinking, okay, one dream I would have for Oregon is to standardize language for all of us to know when it comes to the disaster behavioral health, psychological first aid. With that being said, that would also be great to have it with the area of threat assessment. And there are some great professionals in the state of Oregon that could help with that, and I know there's been other conversations, but having that common understanding terminology. Dr. Ron Glass, he mentioned this, the ORS, with having leave. And I have this because I'm not as familiar. So there is an ORS about leave of absence from employment for search and rescue volunteers that was established in 2015. Mm-hmm. And so at our conference, that came up of why don't we have that in place for people who are asked to go down to Umpqua. And that was an issue, as people could only get away for 2 days. And then we'd have another 2 days, another 2 days.
So, Dr. Blani, on that, that is something that we can have Sione basically pay attention to and look at and research. One of the, with search and rescue, one of the issues that was related to that piece of legislation and actually came out of a task force that started in 08-09 had to do with the pre-credentialing.
So that, which had to do with what?
Pre-credentialing. So that basically, yeah, instead of having a situation for administrative overhead purposes is troubling when people basically say, I got a phone call, I got to go, and there's no pre-development of that conversation, that people that have these particular skills or interests basically have some formalized training that then actually is either through DPSST or through some mechanism so that they're on the list. So when they go, there's, okay, we already know that they have been trained, that they are going, they're pre-credentialed, so they're into the system, as opposed to the one-off, two-off. That's where the administrative overhead, and that's fancy
Absolutely.
Words for the fiscal,
Absolutely.
Becomes mm-hmm. big. We can move in that direction for search and rescue because people have to train to be a part of a search and rescue team.
Mm-hmm.
For these disaster behavioral teams, I think that's certainly a direction we can go into, but as you start looking around at what you would want or what you would need, mm-hmm. one of the pieces that would be critical to make sure and minimize the cost, and what that means is make it more likely to get out of the building, is some type of central nexus for credentialing so that employers have a very brief but effective methodology of knowing who is and who isn't mm-hmm. eligible to go versus, well, I want to help now and I need to leave, and well, I don't need you to leave because yeah. I need you to do my your job, and that kind of conversation.
You're absolutely right. And it makes me think of a conversation we had about just like a first aid card. We need to have people with, you know, the psychological first aid card. Also, ServOR, which is under Oregon Health Authority, is a great database. And I know they're expanding to do SciStar, and it is really a portal where they gather information of statewide volunteers, their credential, their training. So if people go through our training, they store it in their database. Okay. And so that could be a mechanism as well. You know, at Chemeketa, we have a threat assessment non-credit certificate. Thanks, legislatures, for passing that for community colleges to have a non-credit certificate. We are now in 2008 for winter term going to have a disaster behavioral health non-credit certificate. Reason non-credit is because working professionals say, I could care if I get A, B, C. I just want the training and the certificate.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
About another 7 minutes.
Okay.
I'll stop asking questions.
No, you asked all the questions. The support for responders, I know I mentioned that earlier, but it's really an area that we have gotten requests. We're rolling out our first of a series, and it's going to be over in Sun River, where it's a session for just emergency personnel, volunteers, and first responders to make sure they're getting the support that they need. Research. So we are starting research at Chemeketa. We have an institutional review board, which is unique. I think we're the only community college in Oregon to have an IRB. And we have a group of wonderful, somewhat retiree. They like to think they're retired, but they've been champions with helping with the research ideas and moving forward. So we do need to continue the research. I won't spend the whole next 5 minutes on this slide, but I do want to say the social media. Initially, this was part of a training for threat assessment, like how to gather the clues ahead of time and how to do it ethically and legally and you have a lot of different issues. Okay, so this we had this training. It was successful at CCBI downtown Salem. So now we're going to do it as a two-day because what we're finding out is with all these responses, people still need it to prevent. But then when an incident happens, you need skilled people that know how to comb through that data. The trainer that we're bringing up from Arizona is also a police officer, so he uses the example of the Las Vegas that he was involved in that incident and how there was many of them in a room combing through all the Twitter feeds and all the social media, needing to find out where the right feeds were coming from so then we could develop the support areas for those people because sometimes it's different on paper than it is on social media. So that's going to be a big one. We have our two-day threat assessment training next week, and we're instead of going to other states like we have in the past, we're going to just keep rolling them out here in Oregon, but rotating in different locations. I mentioned the psychological first aid in Spanish. Also, we're going to have one for community religious professionals. It was Places of Worship, and we changed the name to this to match the curriculum through UCLA, the SAMHSA curriculum. And so excited to have Reverend Mary Geer and Dr. Rob Lundblad as the leaders for that. Cynthia Valdivia from Washington County is the lead trainer for the Spanish PFA. And then thank you, Chair Evans, for being our opening speaker. We had our second annual Disaster Behavioral Health Conference just a few weeks ago, and we brought in Dr. Fink, who's a medical doctor, but also an investigative reporter for the New York Times, and talked about how the medical professionals are faced with dilemmas and talked about the Hurricane Katrina and other incidents. So save the date for next year. It would be great to have you there at the next February conference. There's my contact information. If I do have a few minutes to play this clip.
Sure.
That way you don't have to hear my voice keep droning on and on.
My goal
and you'll
is
get to hear someone else. It's NPR, and they did a nice summary of the behavioral threat assessment.
That's great. And then we'll have a few questions for you after that.
Sure.
And then we'll
threat
move
assessment
on to
assessment is
a radio.
Yep.
Being used more and more to counter mass shootings. It involves cooperation by institutions as varied as schools, businesses, and the FBI. Mark Fulman writes about it in a new report in Mother Jones. He's the national affairs editor for the magazine. And I asked him how threat assessment works.
Most of the cases begin with some sort of tip where an ordinary citizen gets uncomfortable about something they see in another person and mentions it to a school administrator or to a boss at work. And if the tip makes its way to a threat assessment team, which is a collaborative group of professionals in law enforcement and mental health, those people quickly try to analyze the situation. They gather as much information as possible about the person and then come up with a plan to intervene, which is the third step.
You mentioned at one point in your stories that a really inapt phrase is, boy, I wonder why he snapped. I wonder why he finally broke down. It's almost always a he, by the way. Are there many female mass shooters?
There have been a couple over the last three or four decades, but very few. It's overwhelmingly men.
And then these men are often planning, you say, for months, weeks, months before they actually commit a shooting.
Yes, mass shooters don't snap. Mass shooters and mass murderers are committing a predatory crime. It's not an impulsive crime. The forensic investigations of these crimes show that almost always they've been planned over a period of weeks or months or even years.
It's a very important theme, both of your story in Mother Jones and also in the work of the people whom you write about, that something can be done about this. Steps can be taken to prevent mass shootings. And yet you describe very vividly the story of one young man. Useful steps are taken when he's in his hometown. When he moves to another town, it's a brand new ballgame, and he ultimately pulls off an attack.
Yes, it's really, I think, an extraordinary example of both what's seen as the promise of this strategy, and also its daunting challenges or its limitations. Because really the question at the heart of it is, when do you know if a case is really over? How do you manage someone over the long term who may be vulnerable to acting violently like this? So in the case of Eric Ayala in Portland, he was managed by a threat assessment team for years in another town in Oregon. And when he moved away, years later, went on to commit a mass shooting that seemed to be motivated by the very thing that he had been expressing when he was in high school. Now, is that evidence that he was stopped from committing a mass shooting in high school? No one can really say. But clearly the process of ultimately constructive mental health and social intervention that was done with him worked at least through the period where he was under the care and watch of a threat assessment team. Once he was gone, it was a different story.
Is a threat assessment team at this stage a pilot project in one place that might not exist in another? Or are they more commonly found around the United States? What would you say?
Leaders in this industry don't actually really know how many teams there are operating in the United States. It's a very decentralized model, but there have been three waves of interest in threat assessment. Began with Columbine. There was another big wave of growth after Virginia Tech in 2007. And since Sandy Hook, there have been a lot more teams evolving. You know, in all the reporting I've done on this, I came to realize that in a sense, this is the only really serious major effort going on in our country to deal with mass shootings. You know, everyone is familiar with the political debate, and everyone is familiar with the sense that our political leaders don't act after these happen. So in a certain sense, threat assessment has kind of filled that void. It's really kind of an interesting improvisational solution or a solution of last resort to try to deal with this problem that keeps happening over and over.
Mark Fulman, National Affairs Editor at Mother Jones, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Robert.
Thank you for sharing that. I know that Representative Escobar has a question or two, and then we'll go around the table.
Actually, I don't. I just wanted to say that the worst disaster we ever had in a school was in 1927. A man blew up a school with children in it, the Bath, Michigan. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There were 38 children and 6 adults lost their lives that day, and 58 people were hurt. I have a real situation here where I'm thinking, why aren't we going to the root of the weed instead of trying to nip off the top of the weed? And you're picking up the pieces, I appreciate that, and trying to make it well. But until there's some relaxation of HIPAA, we're going to continue to have this. The other thing is, what has changed in society? When I was in school, which was, I know Alley-Oop was my class president, we had guns in our pickups, in our, you know, and the teachers would come out and take a look at them because they were pretty, but no one ever took one out and shot anyone. Mm-hmm, they didn't even think that way. What has happened to the society that has changed this? Because now we have people, and like you said, maybe they're doing a score. Is that because of a video game type deal where you get bonuses for going back and killing people in the game? I'm not sure what's going on here, but I think we need to real look at what the environment is. You know, you have video games that are very violent. You have television that's very violent. You have movies that are very violent. Well, we didn't have that when I was a kid. When we had Westerns, and everyone knew that was in the past and it was a fantasy. You know. So I'm curious on what we're doing to figure out what. Is it because we've lost the family nucleus? There's got to be a reason out there why society's changed and why people think like they do today.
You want to respond?
Could I? Is that the correct protocol? Sorry, I have forgotten there is a correct protocol.
His comments cover a lot of territory, right, which I think a lot of us share concerns. Mm-hmm. In the time we have, if you could maybe respond in a couple minutes.
Especially, thanks for bringing up Bath, Michigan. I use that in trainings because it's not just a gun issue. And I know that there's issues with guns, but if let's pretend you take it all away, I still think we would see mass murders, whether it's the explosive with fertilizer, with the vehicles. So The increase is also interesting. I get the question about video games. You know, I have young boys that play video games, and I've done a lot of reading about, is there a correlation? What I have found is that people who are on a pathway towards violence find ways to practice and rehearse, whether it's going to the shooting range, and there are several cases where they use video games to rehearse and practice. The other thing you mentioned is it is a societal issue. So it's not just one piece. It is a societal issue. And you're right. It's a big problem. This is one solution, though, if we could figure out how to support individuals, look at the resources in the community, find out if they're involved in their church or the running club or even a shooting range, as weird as that sounds, but something that they're going to find some hope and positive influences in their life. The HIPAA piece is huge, and I wish I would have put a slide in, so I'm glad you brought that up. I get so frustrated. I love HIPAA, and I know the importance of it. I love FERPA, which is what educators use for confidentiality. What I don't like is people not understanding how to interpret these rules and know when there's a safety issue that you need to bring the concern to the table. We do need legislation written, though, about how to interpret, because in Oregon, counselors get so caught up on, it's not an imminent threat. Is that the right way to say it? Imminent threat. So I don't need to report it. So in Washington, they did change their language just last January to where the client might just say, they're going to go shoot up Walmart. I don't have a date. I don't know who. That counselor needs to report it. That's how it really should be, and still honor that confidentiality. So again, I'm getting all excited about that piece, okay. But I know you have
lots of fertile ground there. That's great. I want to make sure to honor everybody's time and also good comments. I think a couple of takeaways that we'll follow up on. HIPAA and FERPA, the safety issue, looking at the Washington legislation. Also, we have something in Oregon called the Titan Fusion Center. Mm-hmm. And we will do a question to find out how much or not they're cooperating with the threat assessment teams, because we have recently learned that they're not always cooperating with ourselves. So we're going to be following up on that. Other questions or comments? Going around the table? Yes?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thanks for doing what you're doing. I think that's really important. I come from a prevention approach in my background and work in psych. And I think that's exactly, somebody made that, maybe it was Representative Esquivel made that case for looking at the root of it rather than the top. And I think that we have been desensitized, and our kids are desensitized, the kinds of, I mean, I watch a lot of police shows too, and you see what happens when there's just like this little burst of red stuff, you know. It doesn't show you what a bullet does to someone's body, their brain, whatever. And I think that when you see something over and over and over again, it's like, oh, that's not so bad. And they don't realize that, I think. They don't realize how powerful it is. And the kinds of bullets in a fire, for example, you know, fire, well, how terrifying would that be to lock everybody in a school room and set it fire, you know, a fire, just as bad or worse as a shooting, you know? So thank you for doing that, and I applaud your having a center, a resource center, and training in that. I like the standardized training, and you know, this is something I'm looking. I made some notes on this. A couple of these things, the first aid, and the training, should be in the second phase of the Oregon Resilience Plan, because we really didn't do enough of the people stuff, you know. And they're doing that. There's a big movement now. They're moving on to the second phase, and this is perfect for that. So. Thank you.
Representative Lightley? Okay. Yep. Well, we're going to close out this segment, but I just want to say a couple of things. Number one, Director McLaren and Board Member Dodson, thank you for allowing a community college. I think one of the values that we have in the state of Oregon is the role of a university, public university, and the role of a community college. They're supplemental to each other, but they're not the same. And I think community colleges, by nature, are much more connected to the community within which they live. And I think the cooperation that I know is occurring because of this center with other community colleges, universities, I just want to applaud the community college for putting investments in a time of scarce resources in one of the only areas that seems to be making a difference with these school shootings. So tip of the hat for that. Second, I fully intend to bring back Dr. Belante and whoever else you want to bring in during the interim to discuss two or three specific follow-ups to what you've mentioned, as well as funding packages. I recommend that you look at House Joint Resolution 23 from the 2015 session. I've sent you a copy of that already. That's what I was typing about, as a way for bonding that would be outside the Measure 5, Measure 47 constraints, specifically for school shooting mitigation packages, where staff and construction related to specifically mitigating where we can, enhancing our response and recovery capabilities, because again, there are so many factors relating to that it will happen again, we know it will. So while we hope and pray that it won't, we also need to be prepared in the meantime. So thank you again for bringing this forward. I appreciate it very much.
And thank you for the time. Also, take care of your own selves. I mean, compassion fatigue is another workshop that we're getting a lot of requests for. So as you're receiving all this information during a busy legislative cycle, I guess, take care of your own mental health. And thanks for
doing this.
Thank you.
So colleagues, as we turn our step to the last order of business for today, I submitted a letter to everybody. Thank you. If you can hang around for a minute, I'd like to talk to you after the committee meeting. A letter is submitted to the committee with the committee's, like, basically, if there's no major objection, this is kind of what I'd like to do moving into the interim. There are three specific items that I think rose to our that need to be attended to before we get into the 2019 session. And what I recommend is three work groups: rail, safety, security, co-chaired by Representatives Lewis and Lively. We mentioned before, anybody, I want to say this for the record, anybody who's listening out there in TV land, any interest, any industry, any advocate, all who hear this, listen carefully. If you seek to influence these work groups, get up off the couch and join. This is an open invitation. We're going to try to reach out to everybody we think should be at the table, but I don't want to hear come January, well, I wasn't invited. You're invited today, because we want to go into the 2019 session with some sense of what we can do, given the preemptions on rail, what we can do to make sure that responders have the information they need and at the same time still not put out information that's a roadmap for terrorists to blow up our rail lines. So that's very important. Representative Lewis and Lively, I ask you to take the lead on that as, again, a co-chair approach. OEM capabilities development. We understand the audit report came out. It emphasized the need for more staff. We also have some concerns about perhaps some of the management techniques at OEM with the staff they have. Bottom line is, those are two separate conversations. They need to both be held. But you can't blame a two-legged frog for not being able to jump as well as a four-legged frog. At some point, you actually have to have enough legs to jump.
You said and OEM.
I'm picturing a four-legged frog.
Owen.
Four flippers. OEM capabilities development, Representative Boone and Esquivel. And I know both of you are perhaps not going to be back in 2019. But here's the best part. You guys have been around the building. You know where the bodies are buried. And because you're not returning, you can actually give us some priorities that we need to deal with. And I challenge you and encourage you to do that.
No retribution.
The third is Veterans Definition Clarification, co-chaired by Representatives Meek and Parrish. And here's the situation. Here's what I'm hoping the work group will come back with. Okay? I have been struggling with, and I will share with committees on an individual basis, a particular constituent issue. Bottom line is, under current law, 17 lawyers agree that even though the intent of the legislation is different than the language, for veterans preference points, you can have a letter from the federal government, Department of Veterans Affairs, saying that you are receiving non-service connected pension and be eligible for veterans preference points, but a letter saying you are service connected from the same VA and not actually meet the requirements because of the way the law has written. Now, we have an amendment in House Bill 4038 that has been fixed, but it is reflective of a larger issue. Over the last 5 years, something happened. In 2009, Governor Kungoski led an effort to make sure that we had a simplified definition of veterans, and the idea was, and this is for legislative intent purposes, that the federal requirements for veterans are often at a threshold designed to limit the federal exposure in terms of resources they have to pay out, so that the state limits would have be a smaller threshold. For example, if the federal requirements for the GI Bill were 180 days, we went to 178 days. Because what happened is the Army was letting people off at 179 days and just under 180, so they didn't have to give them the GI Bill. So we went, fine, we'll go 178. It has always been an effort to make sure that when the DOD changes the game, because again, they've got to manage their costs, we've been at a threshold that is less difficult, less of a requirement to fulfill, because we're playing a different game than what DOD is. Right now, the federal requirements are actually easier to prove than the state requirements have been. Something happened in the last 4 or 5 years. I don't know what it is. What I do know is this. I'm hoping that the work group can come back with a legislative concept, working with legislative council. They've volunteered to help. And I want to say a call out to Lorianne Sills and Dexter. They've been very helpful in this particular process. Boley, every other agency, I think at this point now very much wants to help. What I'm hoping will come back is a baseline definition says, under everywhere the veteran is, whatever the federal government says a veteran is works for us, or something that is actually less of a requirement for specific purposes. That's what I'm asking you to come back with in 2019. Right now, we literally have a matrix that can probably employ lawyers from now till the end of creation because of the mechanics of how federal and state laws interweave and how veteran is defined one way, this way, veteran's disability is applied another way. So here's the deal. By 2019, I'd like the work groups on rail safety to come back with two or three proposals. I think we were close to a compromise before. I ask you guys, if you guys can come to a compromise, I think it will go through the building. OEM capabilities. If you guys can come back with a plan of what the buildup needs to be, how we fund it, and how we hold them accountable, I think that we can do that. I know the governor's office, after that audit, is probably looking for answers on how to make that improvement. The third piece on this definition's clarification, nothing we do is more important as a committee, I think, at this point than making sure the state is getting out of its own way to help the vets, especially as they go through reintegration. So that's what I'm asking the three work groups to do. Representative Post will be our ready reserve to fill in wherever we need. I will be a part of every committee in terms of having to assist, or if I'm in the way, toss me aside and get me out of the way. The way that we structured this is the way that Representative Esquivel have tried to structure this committee since I've been here, is that it's Republican and Democrat, both sides, bipartisan in everything we do. That has been the strength of this committee to get bills through. I value the fact that we don't have a majority one way or the other in this committee, that everything that we do, we try to do by consensus, or at least by pretty clear consensus. And I know for a fact that if the teams that are involved in these work groups can come up with some viable concepts, we will get them through the building and we will actually help some people. So I'm going to stop talking. That's what I'm asking you to do.
Great committee, because it does always does what's right.
So, Mr. Chair?
Yes?
So would you be disappointed if Representative Lewis and I just brought back the solution rather than two or three options?
I would. Steak dinner and a wine of your choice.
Okay.
If you bring back the solution. I mean, we've been fighting over that doggone thing for 3 years.
Be careful. He'll do research and find the most expensive wine he can find on earth.
Well, it would be worth it, because at the end of the day, I know we all want the same thing. I know it. And I trust this committee to find a way. So that's all I have today. If no objection, I'm going to see no objection. We're going to be doing these three work groups. Anything you need from us, Sione and I are going to be staffing and helping. Any industry people you want, any advocates, you let us know. Yes, ma'am.
Are you going to want just updates every legislative days or not? You want this at
I would love it if you did, but my expectation is that by January 2019, or actually by December of 18, we'll have concepts.
Okay.
So you're not quite done.
Not quite.
Okay.
That's okay.
All right. Committee is adjourned. Have a wonderful day.
Not until January 15th.
Thank you.
Don't be Idaho yet.
That's right.
Good. Say,